I can ask for something. Possibly not much, but something. Men are sex machines, said Aunt Lydia, and not much more. They only want one thing. You must learn to manipulate them for your own good. Lead them around by the nose, that is a metaphor. It's nature's way, it's God's device, it's the way things are. Aunt Lydia did not actually say this, but it was implicit in everything she did say. It hovered over her head, like the golden mottos over the saints of the darker ages. Like them, too, she was angular and without flesh. But how to fit the commander into this, as he exists in his study, with his word games and his desire for what? To be played with, to be gently kissed, as if I meant it. I know I need to take it seriously, this desire of his. It could be important, it could be a passport, it could be my downfall. I need to be earnest about it, I need to ponder it. But no matter what I do, sitting here in the dark, with the searchlights illuminating the oblong of my window from outside, through the curtains gauzy as a bridal dress, as ectoplasm, one of my hands holding the other, rocking back and forth a little. No matter what I do, there's something hilarious about it. He wanted me to play Scrabble with him and kiss him as if I meant it. This is one of the most bizarre things that's happened to me ever. Context is all. I remember a television program I once saw, a rerun made years before. I must have been 7 or 8, too young to understand it. It was the sort of thing my mother liked to watch, historical, educational. She tried to explain it to me afterwards, to tell me that the things in it had really happened, but to me it was only a story. I thought someone had made it up. I suppose all children think that, about any history before their own. If it's only a story, it becomes less frightening. The program was a documentary about one of those wars. They interviewed people and showed clips from films of the time, black and white and still photos. I don't remember much about it, but I remember the quality of the pictures, the way everything in them seemed to be coated with a mixture of sunlight and dust, and how dark the shadows were under people's eyebrows and along their cheekbones. The interviews with people still alive then were in color. The one I remember best was with a woman who had been the mistress of a man who had supervised one of the camps where they put the Jews before they killed them. In ovens, my mother said. But there weren't any pictures of the ovens, so I got some confused notion that these deaths had taken place in kitchens. There is something especially terrifying to a child in that idea. Ovens mean cooking, and cooking comes before eating. I thought these people had been eaten, which in a way I suppose they had been. From what they said, the man had been cruel and brutal. The mistress, my mother explained mistress, she did not believe in mystification. I had a pop-up book of sexual organs by the time I was 4. The mistress had once been very beautiful. There was a black-and-white shot of her and another woman in the two-piece bathing suits and platform shoes and picture hats of the time. They were wearing cat's-eye sunglasses and sitting in deck chairs by a swimming pool. The swimming pool was beside their house, which was near the camp with the ovens. The woman said she did not notice much that she found unusual. She denied knowing about the ovens. At the time of the interview, 40 or 50 years later, she was dying of emphysema. She coughed a lot, and she was very thin, almost emaciated. But she still took pride in her appearance. "Look at that," said my mother, half-grudgingly, half-admiringly. "She still takes pride in her appearance." She was carefully made up. Heavy mascara on her eyelashes, rouge on the bones of her cheeks, over which the skin was stretched like a rubber glove pulled tight. She was wearing pearls. "He was not a monster," she said. "People say he was a monster, but he was not one." What could she have been thinking about? Not much, I guess. Not back then, not at the time. She was thinking about how not to think. The times were abnormal. She took pride in her appearance. She did not believe he was a monster. He was not a monster to her. Probably he had some endearing trait. He whistled off-key in the shower. He had a yen for truffles. He called his dog Liebchen and made it sit up for little pieces of raw steak. How easy it is to invent a humanity for anyone at all. What an available temptation. A big child, she would have said to herself. Her heart would have melted. She'd have smoothed the hair back from his forehead, kissed him on the ear, and not just to get something out of him either. The instinct to soothe, to make it better. "There, there," she'd say, as he woke from a nightmare. "Things are so hard for you." All this she would have believed, because otherwise, how could she have kept on living? She was very ordinary under that beauty. She believed in decency. She was nice to the Jewish maid, or nice enough, nicer than she needed to be. Several days after this interview with her was filmed, she killed herself. It said that, right on television. Nobody asked her whether or not she had loved him. What I remember now most of all is the makeup. I stand up in the dark, start to unbutton. Then I hear something inside my body. I've broken. Something has cracked. That must be it. Noise is coming up, coming out of the broken place in my face. Without warning, I wasn't thinking about here or there or anything. If I let the noise get out into the air, it will be laughter. Too loud. Too much of it. Someone is bound to hear, and then there will be hurrying footsteps and commands, and who knows? Judgment. Emotion inappropriate to the occasion. The wandering womb, they used to think. Hysteria. And then a needle. A pill. It could be fatal. I cram both hands over my mouth as if I'm about to be sick, dropped my knees, the laughter boiling like lava in my throat. I crawl into the cupboard, draw up my knees, I choke on it. My ribs hurt with holding back. I shake, I heave, seismic, volcanic, I'll burst. Red all over the cupboard, mirth rhymes with birth. Oh, to die of laughter. I stifle it in the folds of the hanging cloak, clench my eyes from which tears are squeezing, try to compose myself. After a while, it passes, like an epileptic fit. Here I am in the closet. Nolite te bastardes, carborum dorum. I can't see it in the dark, but I trace the tiny scratched writing with the ends of my fingers, as if it's a code in Braille. It sounds in my head now less like a prayer, more like a command. But to do what? Useless to me in any case, an ancient hieroglyph to which the key's been lost. Why did she write it? Why did she bother? There's no way out of here. I lie on the floor, breathing too fast, then slower, evening out my breathing, as in the exercises for giving birth. All I can hear now is the sound of my own heart, opening and closing, opening and closing, opening. 10. Soul Scrolls. Chapter 25. What I heard first the next morning was a scream and a crash. Cora dropping the breakfast tray. It woke me up. I was still half in the cupboard, head on the bundled cloak. I must have pulled it off the hanger and gone to sleep there. For a moment, I couldn't remember where I was. Cora was kneeling beside me. I felt her hand touch my back. She screamed again when I moved. "What's wrong?" I said. I rolled over, pushed myself up. "Oh," she said, "I thought..." She thought what? "Like," she said. The eggs had broken on the floor. There was orange juice and shattered glass. "I'll have to bring another one," she said. "Such a waste. What was he doing on the floor like that?" She was pulling at me to get me up, respectably, onto my feet. I didn't want to tell her I'd never been to bed at all. There would be no way of explaining that. I told her I must have fainted. That was almost as bad because she seized on it. "It's one of the early signs," she said, pleased. That and throwing up. She should have known there hadn't been time enough, but she was very hopeful. "No, it's not that," I said. I was sitting in the chair. "I'm sure it isn't that. I was just dizzy. I was just standing here and things went dark." "It must have been the strain," she said, "of yesterday and all. It takes it out of you." She meant the birth, and I said it did. By this time I was sitting in the chair and she was kneeling on the floor, picking up the pieces of broken glass and egg, gathering them onto the tray. She blotted some of the orange juice with a paper napkin. "I'll have to bring a cloth," she said. "They'll want to know why the extra eggs. Unless you could do without." She looked up at me sideways, slyly, and I saw that it would be better if we could both pretend I'd eaten my breakfast after all. If she said she'd found me lying on the floor, there'd be too many questions. She'd have to account for the broken glass in any case, but Rita would get surly if she had to cook a second breakfast. "I'll do without," I said. "I'm not that hungry." This was good. It fit in with the dizziness. "But I could manage the toast," I said. I didn't want to go without breakfast altogether. "It's been on the floor," she said. "I don't mind," I said. I sat there, eating the piece of brown toast while she went into the bathroom and flushed the handful of egg, which could not be salvaged, down the toilet. Then she came back. "I'll say I dropped the tray on the way out," she said. It pleased me that she was willing to lie for me, even in such a small thing, even for her own advantage. It was a link between us. I smiled at her. "I hope nobody heard you," I said. "It did give me a turn," she said, as she stood in the doorway with the tray. "At first I thought it was just your clothes, like. Then I said to myself, what are they doing there on the floor? I thought maybe you'd..." "Run off," I said. "Well, but," she said, "but it was you." "Yes," I said, "it was." And it was. And she went out with the tray and came back with the cloth for the rest of the orange juice. And Rita that afternoon made a grumpy remark about some folks being all thumbs. "Too much on their minds. Don't look where they're going," she said. And we continued on from there as if nothing had happened. That was in May. Spring has now been undergone. The tulips have had their moment and are done, shedding their petals one by one like teeth. One day I came upon Serena Joy, kneeling on a cushion in the garden, her cane beside her on the grass. She was snipping off the seed pods with a pair of shears. I watched her sideways as I went past, with my basket of oranges and lamb chops. She was aiming, positioning the blades of the shears, then cutting with a convulsive jerk of the hands. Was it the arthritis creeping up? Or some blitzkrieg, some kamikaze, committed on the swelling genitalia of the flowers. The fruiting body. To cut off the seed pods is supposed to make the bulb store energy. Saint Serena on her knees, doing penance. I often amused myself this way, with small, mean-minded, bitter jokes about her, but not for long. It doesn't do to linger, watching Serena Joy from behind. What I coveted was the shears. Well, then we had the irises, rising beautiful and cool on their tall stalks, like blown glass, like pastel water momentarily frozen in a splash, light blue, light mauve, and the darker ones, velvet and purple, black cat's ears in the sun, indigo shadow, and the bleeding hearts, so female in shape it was a surprise they'd not long since been rooted out. There is something subversive about this garden of Serena's, a sense of buried things bursting upwards, wordlessly, into the light, as if to point, to say, whatever is silenced will clamor to be heard, though silently. A Tennyson garden, heavy with scent, languid. The return of the word swoon. Light pours down upon it from the sun, true, but also heat rises from the flowers themselves. You can feel it, like holding your hand an inch above an arm, a shoulder. It breathes in the warmth, breathing itself in. To walk through it in these days of peonies, of pinks and carnations, makes my head swim. The willow is in full plumage and has no help with its insinuating whispers. Rendezvous, it says. Terraces. The sibilance run up my spine, a shiver as if in fever. The summer dress rustles against the flesh of my thighs. The grass grows underfoot. At the edges of my eyes there are movements in the branches. Feathers, flittings, grace notes, tree into bird, metamorphosis run wild. Goddesses are possible now, and the air suffuses with desire. Even the bricks of the house are softening, becoming tactile. If I leaned against them, they'd be warm and yielding. It's amazing what denial can do. Did the sight of my ankle make him lightheaded, faint at the checkpoint yesterday, when I dropped my pass and let him pick it up for me? No handkerchief, no fan. I use what's handy. Winter is not so dangerous. I need hardness, cold, rigidity, not this heaviness, as if I'm a melon on a stem, this liquid ripeness. The commander and I have an arrangement. It's not the first such arrangement in history, though the shape it's taken is not the usual one. I visit the commander two or three nights a week, always after dinner, but only when I get the signal. The signal is Nick. If he's polishing the car when I set out for the shopping, or when I come back, and if his hat is on askew or not on at all, then I go. If he isn't there, or if he has his hat on straight, then I stay in my room in the ordinary way. On ceremony nights, of course, none of this applies. The difficulty is the wife, as always. After dinner, she goes to their bedroom, from where she could conceivably hear me as I sneak along the hall, although I take care to be very quiet. Or she stays in the sitting room, knitting away at her endless angel scarves, turning out more and more yards of intricate and useless wool people. Her form of procreation, it must be. The sitting room door is usually left ajar when she's in there, and I don't dare to go past it. When I've had the signal but can't make it, down the stairs or along the hall past the sitting room, the commander understands. He knows my situation, none better. He knows all the rules. Sometimes, however, Serena Joy is out, visiting another commander's wife, a sick one. That's the only place she could conceivably go, by herself in the evenings. She takes food, a cake or pie or loaf of bread baked by Rita, or a jar of jelly made from the mint leaves that grow in her garden. They get sick a lot, these wives of the commanders. It adds interest to their lives. As for us, the handmaids and even the Marthas, we avoid illness. The Marthas don't want to be forced to retire because who knows where they go? You don't see that many old women around anymore. And as for us, any real illness, anything lingering, weakening, a loss of flesh or appetite, a fall of hair, a failure of the glands would be terminal. I remember Cora earlier in the spring, staggering around even though she had the flu, holding on to the door frames when she thought no one was looking, being careful not to cough. "A slight cold," she said, when Serena asked her. Serena herself sometimes takes a few days off, tucked up in bed. Then she's the one to get the company, the wives rustling up the stairs, clucking and cheerful. She gets the cakes and pies, the jelly, the bouquets of flowers from their gardens. They take turns. There is some sort of list, invisible, unspoken. Each is careful not to hog more than her share of the attention. On the nights when Serena is due to be out, I'm sure to be summoned. The first time I was confused. His needs were obscure to me, and what I could perceive of them seemed to me ridiculous, laughable, like a fetish for lace-up shoes. Also, there had been a letdown of sorts. What had I been expecting behind that closed door the first time? Something unspeakable, down on all fours, perhaps, perversions, whips, mutilations. At the very least, some minor sexual manipulation, some bygone peccadillo now denied him, prohibited by law and punishable by amputation. To be asked to play Scrabble instead, as if we were an old married couple or two children, seemed kinky in the extreme, a violation in its own way. As a request, it was opaque. So when I left the room, it still wasn't clear to me what he wanted or why, or whether I could fulfill any of it for him. If there's to be a bargain, the terms of exchange must be set forth. This was something he certainly had not done. I thought he might be toying, some cat-and-mouse routine, but now I think that his motives and desires weren't obvious even to him. They had not yet reached the level of words. The second evening began in the same way as the first. I went to the door, which was closed, knocked on it, was told to come in. Then followed the same two games, with the smooth beige counters. Prolix. Quartz. Quandary. Sylph. Rhythm. All the old tricks with consonants I could dream up or remember. My tongue felt thick with the effort of spelling. It was like using a language I'd once known but had nearly forgotten, a language having to do with customs that had long before passed out of the world. Café au lait at an outdoor table, with a brioche, absinthe in a tall glass, or shrimp in a cornucopia of newspaper. Things I'd read about once but had never seen. It was like trying to walk without crutches, like those phony scenes in old TV movies. You can do it. I know you can. That was the way my mind lurched and stumbled, among the sharp R's and T's, sliding over the ovoid vowels as if on pebbles. The commander was patient when I hesitated or asked him for a correct spelling. We can always look it up in the dictionary, he said. He said we. The first time I realized he'd let me win. That night I was expecting everything to be the same, including the goodnight kiss. But when we finished the second game, he sat back in his chair. He placed his elbows on the arms of the chair, the tips of his fingers together, and looked at me. I have a little present for you, he said. He smiled a little. Then he pulled open the top drawer of his desk and took something out. He held it a moment, casually enough, between thumb and finger, as if deciding whether or not to give it to me. Although it was upside down from where I was sitting, I recognized it. They were once common enough. It was a magazine. A women's magazine, it looked like from the picture. A model on glossy paper. Hair blown, neck scarfed, mouth lipsticked. The fall fashions. I thought such magazines had all been destroyed, but here was one left over in a commander's private study where you'd least expect to find such a thing. He looked down at the model who was right side up to him. He was still smiling, that wistful smile of his. It was a look you'd give to an almost extinct animal at the zoo. Staring at the magazine as he dangled it before me like fish bait, I wanted it. I wanted it with a force that made the ends of my fingers ache. At the same time, I saw this longing of mine as trivial and absurd because I'd taken such magazines lightly enough once. I'd read them in dentist's office and sometimes on planes. I'd bought them to take to hotel rooms, a device to fill in empty time while I was waiting for Luke. After I'd leafed through them, I would throw them away, for they were infinitely discardable, and a day or two later I wouldn't be able to remember what had been in them. Though I remembered now. What was in them was promise. They dealt in transformations. They suggested an endless series of possibilities, extending like the reflections in two mirrors set facing one another, stretching on, replica after replica, to the vanishing point. They suggested one adventure after another, one wardrobe after another, one improvement after another, one man after another. They suggested rejuvenation, pain overcome and transcended, endless love. The real promise in them was immortality. This was what he was holding without knowing it. He riffled the pages. I felt myself leaning forward. "It's an old one," he said, "a curio of sorts. From the 70s, I think. A Vogue." This like a wine connoisseur dropping a name. "I thought you might like to look at it." I hung back. He might be testing me, to see how deep my indoctrination had really gone. "It's not permitted," I said. "In here it is," he said quietly. I saw the point. Having broken the main taboo, why should I hesitate over another one, something minor? Or another. Who could tell where it might stop? Behind this particular door, taboo dissolved. I took the magazine from him and turned it the right way around. There they were again, the images of my childhood, bold, striding, confident, their arms flung out as if to claim space, their legs apart, feet planted squarely on the earth. There was something Renaissance about the pose, but it was princes I thought of, not coiffed and ringleted maidens. Those candid eyes, shadowed, with makeup, yes, but like the eyes of cats, fixed for the pounce. No quailing, no clinging there, not in those capes and rough tweeds, those boots that came to the knee. Pirates, these women, with their ladylike briefcases for the loot and their horsey, acquisitive teeth. I felt the commander watching me as I turned the pages. I knew I was doing something I shouldn't have been doing and that he found pleasure in seeing me do it. I should have felt evil. By Aunt Lydia's lights, I was evil. But I didn't feel evil. Instead, I felt like an old Edwardian seaside postcard. Naughty. What was he going to give me next? A girdle? "Why do you have this?" I asked him. "Some of us," he said, "retain an appreciation for the old things." "These were supposed to have been burned," I said. "There were house-to-house searches, bonfires." "What's dangerous in the hands of the multitudes," he said, with what may or may not have been irony, "is safe enough for those whose motives are beyond reproach," I said. He nodded gravely, impossible to tell whether or not he meant it. "But why show it to me?" I said, and then felt stupid. What could he possibly say? That he was amusing himself at my expense? For he must have known how painful it was to me to be reminded of the former time. I wasn't prepared for what he actually did say. "Who else could I show it to?" he said. And there it was again, that sadness. "Should I go further?" I thought. I didn't want to push him, too far, too fast. I knew I was dispensable. Nevertheless, I said, too softly, "How about your wife?" He seemed to think about that. "No," he said, "she wouldn't understand. Anyway, she won't talk to me much anymore. We don't seem to have much in common these days." So there it was, out in the open. His wife didn't understand him. That's what I was there for then. The same old thing. It was too banal to be true. On the third night, I asked him for some hand lotion. I didn't want to sound begging, but I wanted what I could get. "Some what?" he said, courteous as ever. He was across the desk from me. He didn't touch me much except for that one obligatory kiss. No pawing, no heavy breathing, none of that. It would have been out of place somehow, for him as well as for me. "Hand lotion," I said. "Or face lotion. Our skin gets very dry." For some reason I said "our" instead of "my." I would have liked to ask also for some bath oil and those little colored globules you used to be able to get that were so much like magic to me when they existed in the round glass bowl in my mother's bathroom at home. But I thought he wouldn't know what they were. Anyway, they probably weren't made anymore. "Dry?" the commander said, as if he'd never thought about that before. "What do you do about it?" "We use butter," I said. "When we can get it, or margarine. A lot of the time it's margarine." "Butter," he said, musing. "That's very clever." "Butter," he laughed. I could have slapped him. "I think I could get some of that," he said, as if indulging a child's wish for bubble gum. "But she might smell it on you." I wondered if this fear of his came from past experience. Long past. Lipstick on the collar, perfume on the cuffs, a scene late at night in some kitchen or bedroom. A man devoid of such experience wouldn't think of that, unless he's craftier than he looks. "I'd be careful," I said. "Besides, she's never that close to me." "Sometimes she is," he said. I looked down. I'd forgotten about that. I could feel myself blushing. "I won't use it on those nights," I said. On the fourth evening, he gave me the hand lotion in an unlabeled plastic bottle. It wasn't very good quality. It smelled faintly of vegetable oil. No lily of the valley for me. It may have been something they made up for use in hospitals on bed sores, but I thanked him anyway. "The trouble is," I said, "I don't have anywhere to keep it." "In your room," he said, as if it were obvious. "They'd find it," I said. "Someone would find it." "Why?" he asked, as if he really didn't know. Maybe he didn't. It wasn't the first time he gave evidence of being truly ignorant of the real conditions under which we lived. "They look," I said. "They look in all our rooms." "What for?" he said. I think I lost control then, a little. "Razor blades," I said. "Books, writing, black market stuff. All the things we aren't supposed to have. Jesus Christ, you ought to know." My voice was angrier than I'd intended, but he didn't even wince. "Then you'll have to keep it here," he said. So that's what I did. He watched me smoothing it over my hands and then my face with that same air of looking in through the bars. I wanted to turn my back on him. It was as if he were in the bathroom with me. But I didn't dare. For him, I must remember, I am only a whim.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Is Audible.
And now, part two of The Handmaid's Tale, written by Margaret Atwood and read by Claire Danes.
Chapter 26. When the night for the ceremony came round again, 2 or 3 weeks later, I found that things were changed. There was an awkwardness now that there hadn't been before. Before, I'd treated it as a job. An unpleasant job to be gone through as fast as possible so it could be over with. "Steel yourself," my mother used to say before examinations I didn't want to take or swims in cold water. I never thought much at the time about what the phrase meant, but it had something to do with metal, with armor. And that's what I would do. I would steel myself. I would pretend not to be present, not in the flesh. This state of absence, of existing apart from the body, had been true of the commander too, I knew now. Probably he thought about other things the whole time he was with me, with us, for of course Serena Joy was there on those evenings also. He might have been thinking about what he did during the day, or about playing golf, or about what he had for dinner. The sexual act, although he performed it in a perfunctory way, must have been largely unconscious for him, like scratching himself. But that night, the first since the beginning of whatever this new arrangement was between us, I had no name for it, I felt shy of him. I felt, for one thing, that he was actually looking at me, and I didn't like it. The lights were on, as usual, since Serena Gioia always avoided anything that would have created an aura of romance or eroticism, however slight. Overhead lights, harsh, despite the canopy. It was like being on an operating table, in the full glare, like being on a stage. I was conscious that my legs were hairy, in the straggly way of legs that had once been shaved but have grown back. I was conscious of my armpits, too, although, of course, he couldn't see them. I felt uncouth. This act of copulation, fertilization, perhaps, what should have been no more to me than a bee is to a flower, had become for me indecorous, an embarrassing breach of propriety, which it hadn't been before. He was no longer a thing to me. That was the problem. I realized it that night, and the realization has stayed with me. It complicates. Serena Joy had changed for me, too. Once I'd merely hated her for her part in what was being done to me, and because she hated me, too, and resented my presence, and because she would be the one to raise my child, should I be able to have one after all. But now, although I still hated her, no more so than when she was gripping my hands so hard that her rings bit my flesh, pulling my hands back as well, which she must have done on purpose to make me as uncomfortable as she could. The hatred was no longer pure and simple. Partly I was jealous of her. But how could I be jealous of a woman so obviously dried up and unhappy? You can only be jealous of someone who has something you think you ought to have yourself. Nevertheless, I was jealous. But I also felt guilty about her. I felt I was an intruder in a territory that ought to have been hers. Now that I was seeing the commander on the sly, if only to play his games and listen to him talk, our functions were no longer as separate as they should have been in theory. I was taking something away from her, although she didn't know it. I was filching. Never mind that it was something she apparently didn't want or had no use for, had rejected, even. Still, it was hers, and if I took it away, this mysterious it I couldn't quite define, for the commander wasn't in love with me. I refused to believe he felt anything for me as extreme as that. What would be left for her? Why should I care? I told myself. She's nothing to me. She dislikes me. She'd have me out of the house in a minute or worse if she could think up any excuse at all. If she were to find out, for instance. He wouldn't be able to intervene, to save me. The transgressions of women in the household, whether Martha or handmaid, are supposed to be under the jurisdiction of the wives alone. She was a malicious and vengeful woman, I knew that. Nevertheless, I couldn't shake it, that small compunction towards her. Also, I now had power over her of a kind, although she didn't know it, and I enjoyed that. Why pretend? I enjoyed it a lot. But the commander could give me away so easily, by a look, by a gesture, some tiny slip that would reveal to anyone watching that there was something between us now. He almost did it the night of the ceremony. He reached his hand up as if to touch my face. I moved my head to the side to warn him away, hoping Serena Joy hadn't noticed, and he withdrew his hand again, withdrew into himself and his single-minded journey. "Don't do that again," I said to him the next time we were alone. "Do what?" he said. "Try to touch me like that when she's there." "Did I?" he said. "You could get me transferred," I said. "To the colonies, you know that. Or worse." I thought he should continue to act in public, as if I were a large vase or a window, part of the background, inanimate or transparent. "I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't mean to, but I find it..." "What?" I said, when he didn't go on. impersonal, he said. How long did it take you to find that out? I said. You can see from the way I was speaking to him that we were already on different terms. For the generations that come after, Aunt Lydia said, it will be so much better. The women will live in harmony together, all in one family. You will be like daughters to them, and when the population level is up to scratch again, we'll no longer have to transfer you from one house to another because there will be enough to go round. There can be bonds of real affection, she said, blinking at us ingratiatingly, under such conditions. Women united for a common end. Helping one another in their daily chores as they walk the path of life together, each performing her appointed task. Why expect one woman to carry out all the functions necessary to the serene running of a household? It isn't reasonable or humane. Your daughters will have greater freedom. We are working towards the goal of a little garden for each one of you. The clasped hands again, the breathy voice. And that's just one, for instance. The raised finger wagging at us. But we can't be greedy pigs and demand too much before it's ready. Now can we? The fact is that I'm his mistress. Men at the top have always had mistresses. Why should things be any different now? The arrangements aren't quite the same, granted. The mistress used to be kept in a minor house or apartment of her own, and now they've amalgamated things. But underneath it's the same, more or less. Outside woman, they used to be called in some countries. I am the outside woman. It's my job to provide what is otherwise lacking. Even the Scrabble. It's an absurd as well as an ignominious position. Sometimes I think she knows. Sometimes I think they're in collusion. Sometimes I think she put him up to it and is laughing at me, as I laugh from time to time and with irony at myself. Let her take the weight, she can say to herself. Maybe she's withdrawn from him almost completely. Maybe that's her version of freedom. But even so, and stupidly enough, I'm happier than I was before. It's something to do, for one thing. Something to fill the time at night instead of sitting alone in my room. It's something else to think about. I don't love the commander or anything like it, but he's of interest to me. He occupies space. He's more than a shadow. And I for him. To him, I'm no longer merely a usable body. To him, I'm not just a boat with no cargo, a chalice with no wine in it, an oven to be crude, minus the bun. To him, I am not merely empty. Chapter 27. I walk with Of Glen along the summer street. It's warm, humid. This would have been sundress and sandals weather once. In each of our baskets are strawberries. The strawberries are in season now, so we'll eat them until we're sick of them. And some wrapped fish. We got the fish at Loaves and Fishes, with its wooden sign, a fish with a smile and eyelashes. It doesn't sell loaves, though. Most households bake their own, though you can get dried-up rolls and wizened donuts at Daily Bread if you run short. Loaves and Fishes is hardly ever open. Why bother opening when there's nothing to sell? The sea fisheries were defunct several years ago. The few fish they have now are from fish farms and taste muddy. The news says the coastal areas are being rested. Sole, I remember, and haddock. Swordfish, scallops, tuna, lobsters stuffed and baked, salmon, pink and fat, grilled in steaks. Could they all be extinct, like the whales? I've heard that rumor passed on to me in soundless words, the lips hardly moving, as we stood in line outside, waiting for the store to open, lured by the picture of succulent white fillets in the window. They put the picture in the window when they have something, take it away when they don't. Sign language. Of Glen and I walk slowly today. were hot in our long dresses, wet under the arms, tired. At least in this heat, we don't wear gloves. There used to be an ice cream store somewhere in this block. I can't remember the name. Things can change so quickly. Buildings can be torn down or turned into something else. It's hard to keep them straight in your mind the way they used to be. You could get double scoops, and if you wanted, they would put chocolate sprinkles on the top. These had the name of a man. Johnny's? Jackie's? I can't remember. We would go there when she was little, and I'd hold her up so she could see through the glass side of the counter where the vats of ice cream were on display, colored so delicately, pale orange, pale green, pale pink, and I'd read the names to her so she could choose. She wouldn't choose by the name, though, but by the color. Her dresses and overalls were those colors, too. Ice cream pastels. Jimmy's, that was the name. Of Glenn and I are more comfortable with one another now. We're used to each other. Siamese twins. We don't bother much with the formalities anymore when we greet each other. We smile and move off, in tandem, traveling smoothly along our daily track. Now and again we vary the route. There's nothing against it, as long as we stay within the barriers. A rat in a maze is free to go anywhere, as long as it stays inside the maze. We've been to the stores already, and the church. Now we're at the wall. Nothing on it today. They don't leave the bodies hanging as long in summer as they do in winter, because of the flies and the smell. This was once the land of air sprays, pine and floral, and people retain the taste, especially the commanders, who preach purity in all things. "You have everything on your list?" Of Glenn says to me now, though she knows I do. Our lists are never long. She's given up some of her passivity lately, some of her melancholy. Often she speaks to me first. "Yes," I say. "Let's go around," she says. She means down, towards the river. We haven't been that way for a while. "Fine," I say. I don't turn at once, though, but remain standing where I am, taking a last look at the wall. There are the red bricks. There are the searchlights. There's the barbed wire. There are the hooks. Somehow the wall is even more foreboding when it's empty like this. When there's someone hanging on it, at least you know the worst. But vacant, it is also potential, like a storm approaching. When I can see the bodies, the actual bodies, when I can guess from the sizes and shapes that none of them is Luke, I can believe also that he is still alive. I don't know why I expect him to appear on this wall. There are hundreds of other places they could have killed him. But I can't shake the idea that he's in there, at this moment, behind the blank red bricks. I try to imagine which building he's in. I can remember where the buildings are, inside the wall. We used to be able to walk freely there, when it was a university. We still go in there once in a while, for women's salvagings. Most of the buildings are red brick, too. Some have arched doorways, a Romanesque effect from the 19th century. We aren't allowed inside the buildings anymore. But who would want to go in? Those buildings belong to the eyes. Maybe he's in the library, somewhere in the vaults, the stacks. The library is like a temple. There's a long flight of white steps leading to the rank of doors. Then, inside, another white staircase going up. To either side of it, on the wall, there are angels. Also, there are men fighting, or about to fight, looking clean and noble, not dirty and bloodstained and smelly the way they must have looked. Victory is on one side of the inner doorway, leading them on, and death is on the other. It's a mural in honor of some war or other. The men on the side of death are still alive. They're going to heaven. Death is a beautiful woman, with wings and one breast almost bare. Or is that victory? I can't remember. They won't have destroyed that. We turn our backs to the wall, head left. Here, there are several empty storefronts, their glass windows scrawled with soap. I try to remember what was sold in them once. Cosmetics? Jewelry? Most of the stores carrying things for men are still open. It's just the ones dealing in what they call vanities that have been shut down. At the corner is the store known as Soul Scrolls. It's a franchise. There are Soul Scrolls in every city center, in every suburb, or so they say. It must make a lot of profit. The window of Soul Scrolls is shatterproof. Behind it are printout machines, row on row of them. These machines are known as Holy Rollers, but only among us. It's a disrespectful nickname. What the machines print is prayers, roll upon roll, prayers going out endlessly. They're ordered by CompuPhone. I've overheard the commander's wife doing it. Ordering prayers from Soul Scrolls is supposed to be a sign of piety and faithfulness to the regime, so of course, the commander's wives do it a lot. It helps their husbands' careers. There are 5 different prayers. For health, wealth, a death, a birth, a sin. You pick the one you want, punch in the number, then punch in your own number so your account will be debited, and punch in the number of times you want the prayer repeated. The machines talk as they print out the prayers. If you like, you can go inside and listen to them, the toneless metallic voices repeating the same thing over and over. Once the prayers have been printed out and said, the paper rolls back through another slot and is recycled into fresh paper again. There are no people inside the building. The machines run by themselves. You can't hear the voices from outside, only a murmur, a hum, like a devout crowd on its knees. Each machine has an eye painted in gold on the side, flanked by 2 small golden wings. I try to remember what this place sold when it was a store, before it was turned into Soul Scrolls. I think it was lingerie. Pink and silver boxes, colored pantyhose, brassieres with lace, silk scarves. Something lost. Of Glenn and I stand outside Soul Scrolls, looking through the shatterproof windows, watching the prayers well out from the machines and disappear again through the slot, back to the realm of the unsaid. Now I shift my gaze. What I see is not the machines, but of Glenn, reflected in the glass of the window. She's looking straight at me. We can see into each other's eyes. This is the first time I've ever seen of Glenn's eyes directly, steadily, not aslant. Her face is oval, pink, plump, but not fat, her eyes roundish. She holds my stare in the glass, level, unwavering. Now it's hard to look away. There's a shock in this seeing. It's like seeing somebody naked for the first time. There is risk suddenly in the air between us, where there was none before. Even this meeting of eyes holds danger, though there's nobody near. At last, of Glenn speaks. "Do you think God listens?" she says. "To these machines?" She is whispering, our habit at the center. In the past, this would have been a trivial enough remark, a kind of scholarly speculation. Right now, it's treason. I could scream. I could run away. I could turn from her silently to show her I won't tolerate this kind of talk in my presence. Subversion, sedition, blasphemy, heresy, all rolled into one. I steel myself. "No," I say. She lets out her breath and a long sigh of relief. We have crossed the invisible line together. "Neither do I," she says. "Though I suppose it's faith of a kind," I say, "like Tibetan prayer wheels." "What are those?" she asks. "I only read about them," I say. "They're moved around by the wind. They're all gone now." "Like everything," she says. Only now do we stop looking at one another. "Is it safe here?" I whisper. "I figure it's the safest place," she says. "We look like we're praying, is all." "What about them?" "Them?" she says, still whispering. You're always safest out of doors, no mic. And why would they put one here? They'd think nobody would dare. But we've stayed long enough. There's no sense in being late getting back. We turn away together. Keep your head down as we walk, she says, and lean just a little towards me. That way I can hear you better. Don't talk when there's anyone coming. We walk, heads bent as usual. I'm so excited I can hardly breathe, but I keep a steady pace. Now more than ever, I must avoid drawing attention to myself. I thought you were a true believer, of Glenn says. I thought you were, I say. You were always so stinking pious. So were you, I reply. I want to laugh, shout, hug her. You can join us, she says. Us, I say. There is an us, then. There's a we. I knew it. You didn't think I was the only one, she says. I didn't think that. It occurs to me that she may be a spy, a plant, set to trap me, such as the soil in which we grow. But I can't believe it. Hope is rising in me like sap in a tree, blood in a wound. We have made an opening. I want to ask her if she's seen Moira, if anyone can find out what's happened, to Luke, to my child, my mother even, but there's not much time. Too soon we're approaching the corner of the main street, the one before the first barrier. There will be too many people. Don't say a word, of Glenn warns me, though she doesn't need to, in any way. Of course I won't, I say. Who could I tell? We walk the main street in silence, past lilies, past all flesh. There are more people on the sidewalks this afternoon than usual. The warm weather must have brought them out. Women in green, blue, red stripes, men too, some in uniform, some only in civilian suits. The sun is free. It is still there to be enjoyed, though no one bathes in it anymore, not in public. There are more cars, too, whirlwinds with their chauffeurs and their cushioned occupants, lesser cars driven by lesser men. Something is happening. There is a commotion, a flurry among the shoals of cars. Some are pulling over to the side as if to get out of the way. I look up quickly. It's a black van with the white winged eye on the side. It doesn't have the siren on, but the other cars avoid it anyway. It cruises slowly along the street as if looking for something, shark on the prowl. I freeze. Cold travels through me down to my feet. There must have been microphones. They've heard us after all. Of Glenn, under cover of her sleeve, grips my elbow. Keep moving, she whispers. Pretend not to see. But I can't help seeing. Right in front of us, the van pulls up. Two eyes in gray suits leap from the opening double doors at the back. They grab a man who is walking along, a man with a briefcase, an ordinary-looking man, slam him back against the black side of the van. He's there a moment, splayed out against the metal as if stuck to it. Then one of the eyes moves in on him, does something sharp and brutal that doubles him over into a limp cloth bundle. They pick him up and heave him into the back of the van like a sack of mail. Then they are also inside, and the doors are closed, and the van moves on. It's over in seconds, and the traffic on the street resumes as if nothing has happened. What I feel is relief. It wasn't me. Chapter 28. I don't feel like a nap this afternoon. There's still too much adrenaline. I sit on the window seat, looking out through the semi-sheer of the curtains. White nightgown. The window is as open as it goes. There's a breeze, hot in the sunlight, and the white cloth blows across my face. From the outside, I must look like a cocoon, a spook, face enshrouded like this. Only the outlines visible, of nose, bandaged mouth, blind eyes. But I like the sensation, the soft cloth brushing my skin. It's like being in a cloud. They've given me a small electric fan, which helps in this humidity. It whirs on the floor, in the corner, its blades encased in grillwork.